want to say how thankful I am to Brother Don and how I appreciate what he stands for. I know he loves the truth. He stands for the truth. I read things that he writes, and I know he must be an incredible preacher, although I've never been able to hear him preach. And I'm sorry also if y'all can't understand. I am speaking English this morning, and so if you have any difficulty with it, raise your hand. I don't think that I can do anything about it, but you can raise your hand. I also want to say that we've been praying for you guys and praying about these wildfires. This is an experience we've never had before, and I was beginning to wonder if we were even going to be able to. Don and I mentioned this in correspondence a few days ago. I didn't even know for sure we were even going to be able to be here today because of the wildfires. But the last time I came, we got on the airplane. We were ready to fly out here. They said we're going to be delayed because of storms. We were going to miss our connection in Houston, and they said so. I called United. They said get off of that plane, get your luggage, we will rebook you. So we got off the plane, got our luggage, they rebooked us, and the flight was going to get us here after your services the next day. So there was no need to try to do that. And so anyway, I really apologize, but that was totally and completely out of our control. Now I'm here this morning because I want you all to be excited about what's going on. Here in Acts chapter 14 and verse 27, you know, when Paul would complete his missionary journeys, he would come back to the church at Antioch, and he would tell the things that had happened on those journeys. And I often think about the church and how excited they must have been because they had been praying about this. You remember the church got together when they went on their first missionary journey, and they laid hands on Paul and Barnabas, and they prayed with them, did all, you know. And so the church must have been really excited to hear what was going on. Now, you're a part of this work, and so I'm here this morning to exhort you and encourage you because of what you're doing on the other side of the world. I also want to mention, because what Paul said when it came back, he said he had gathered the church together and rehearsed all that God had done. This is God's work. It's not Don and Kathy Iverson's work. I want to tell you that me and my wife are not very smart people. We're maybe average, or maybe below, for me, average intellect. But God uses us. Now it says in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 27 that God takes the foolish things of this world to confound the wise. And so a lot of people look at me and they're scratching, the smart people look at me and scratching their head, I guess. But I'm saying all that because I want to share with you some incredible things. I think this is one of the greatest works in all of the world, and I don't want anybody to think for one minute that we're bragging on ourselves, because we just are in unbelief that God would let us be a part of such a great work as this. And so we want to be sure that that God gets all of the glory. I've got to turn it on. Thank you, brother. These are just some pictures of some of our children in the children's home. I'll get into that a little bit more toward the end of the presentation. Those two pictures snuck in. Now, as I mentioned in that first slide, the work that we do is under the oversight of the elders in Crossville, Tennessee. When you actually started supporting this work during the tsunami, we had elders at Banner Elk. And Banner Elk is a small congregation. And I got so heavily involved in India, I wasn't even in Banner Elk enough to be an elder. And so I resigned as an elder. There were only two of us. And so that did away with our eldership. Now, work this large needs to be under an eldership. So we went to the Crossville elders, and they agreed to take over the oversight of our work. The man that you see in the middle on that side is Brother Jonathan Loveday. He just got back from India with us after coming. It was a wonderful experience for him to be there, because one of the things that we're doing right now is really working to get elders established in the congregations. And because of him being an elder, he was able to speak to the men about the practicality of being an elder. Our men they have the qualifications for elders memorized. They really understand the concept completely, but it's difficult to understand how an eldership functions and how you're supposed to act and what you're supposed to do and what your authority is supposed to be and how the congregation is supposed to react to you. In other words, the logistics of the eldership are the things they don't understand. And so Brother Jonathan, he's speaking to one of our one of our schools down here at the bottom. There are 14 schools right now that you are helping to support, where we're training men and putting more boots on the ground. We also had a couple of young men that came along from the congregation there, and they were able to speak to our young people. I like to show this everywhere I go because we need to look at the world the way that God looks at the world. And 60% of the population of the world is in Asia. And of course, India is part of that. And most of these people do not, they may have heard of Jesus Christ, but as far as really knowing about Him or knowing His plan of salvation or why He came to this earth or that He was God in the flesh, they don't have that kind of knowledge. Now that's 60% of the world's population. And then you come to 15% of the population being in Europe. And I just want to say that I'm thankful that I was not born in Europe, because the chances of me being a member of the Lord's church and the chances of me having heard the truth would be very, very slim if I had been born in Europe. I love European people. I was one of them. My ancestors were Europeans, but I'm thankful that I was not born there. I'm thankful that I was born where I was born. 12% in Africa, 8% in Latin America, 5% in North America. Aren't we blessed? That little red slice up there, only 5 out of 100 people that were born on my birthday were actually born in this country, and I am part of that 5%. That means I grew up with a Bible on the end tables in my house and on the coffee table. I was taken to Sunday school every Sunday when I was just a little tyke. And my grandma saw to it, my mother saw to it, that I was raised knowing the true and living God. And we really take that for granted in this country, that we know the true and living God. India is a country made up of Hindus. 95% of the population of India are Hindus. Hinduism is a language born out of superstition. Any language that is born any religion that is born aside from the Word of God is a religion born of superstition and born of men's ideas. The lady that you see here in the picture, you'll notice there's a spear through her jaw. A spear that's about 15 feet long. And what she's done, I took this picture out of the back of the car because I didn't want to get out, because I didn't know if they'd be friendly to me or if they'd be hostile. I took the picture out of the back of the car, and we see this very often. She's a Hindu devotee. She has made a vow to her Hindu gods, and then they take this spear, and without numbing her up or without anything as far as killing germs, or they just push this spear through their jaws, and then they will walk for days with that spear going to a temple on the top of a mountain. And it's heartbreaking when you see people with this kind of, you know, Paul said in, I think it's Romans chapter 10, 1 and 2, they have a zeal, but it's not according to knowledge. She's very zealous, but she doesn't have the knowledge to know the true and living God who created her. And so it's heartbreaking to see people with this kind of zeal and to know that they're doing that for nothing. Now, the way Paul said it in 1 Thessalonians chapter 1 and verse 9, he says, "For they themselves show of what manner of entering in we had into you, and how that you turned to God from idols to serve the living and true God." This is the greatest experience, I believe, that an individual can have in this life. That is that you take someone who's worshiping idols and you turn them to worship the true and living God. There are many times when we'll be studying the Bible with someone for several weeks and we get to know them very well, and then they're baptized into the body of Christ, and then on Sunday morning you're taking communion with them for the first time, and you're looking at their mouth as they're trying to mouth the words of the song. They don't know it yet, but they're trying to mouth the words of the song, and you think that mouth was created by the God who you're singing to now, the true and living God. And there is no greater thing. I don't care if you own Walmart or Microsoft or who you are or how important you are, there is nothing more important than to turn an individual to know and to serve the true and living God. And This is, of course, and we're going to talk about this a little bit more in the sermon this morning, but one soul is worth more than all of the world. That's why I can comfortably say the greatest thing you can do with your life that any of us can do with our lives is to cause a soul to be saved in the end. That's the most important thing that we can do. To give you an example of that, a few years ago, we started working in the jungles, and we've now established several congregations in the jungles. And by the way, brethren, last year, there were 106 new congregations of the Churches of Christ established by the men with whom I work in India. 106 new congregations. Brother Selvam was baptized on January the 9th. And he was on his way home in the afternoon. He was on a motorcycle, he and two other men, which is amazing because there's usually five to seven men on a motorcycle. But there were three of them on the motorcycle. They rounded a corner. There was an elephant. All the men jumped off the motorcycle and took off running. You do not have a chance against an elephant. The elephant caught Selvam, took him and bashed his body against a rock or a tree or something, killed him immediately, and then stood there over his body all night and would not let the authorities come in to take the body away. But I told Kathy when I heard about this, that man was baptized in the body of Christ on January the 9th, and he died on January the 12th. And I told her, I said, in the 21 years that we've been working in India, if all we could do, because you know, according to what the Word says, and according to this man's faith, he's likely in paradise awaiting now the judgment day so he can pass on into eternity in heaven. And that man being in paradise makes 21 years of our work worth it. If he is the only one, because that one soul is worth more than all of the world. But anyway, the picture that you see here, a few days later, the elephant returned to the scene. The people were on the bus. They were on their way back to the village. The elephant was standing there in the middle of the road, and they were very frightened because, let me tell you, this elephant can do whatever he wants to do with that bus. I had one to get after me one time, and I managed to, I don't know how I got away. The elephant stopped. I don't know what caused it to stop, but the elephant stopped. I was on my way to the car, me and two other men, and I think the elephant was thinking, yeah, y'all get in that car and I'll get all three of you at one time. An elephant is a powerful animal and they can run they can run like 15 or 20 miles an hour. You cannot outrun an elephant. But anyway, you know, another program that we're involved in is we help widows. Widows in India are a very sad sight, because in the Hindu religion, you know, they believe in reincarnation. And so if bad things happen to you in this life, many of them believe it's because of something you did bad in your former life. And if they associate with you, then that bad karma will rub off on you. And so consequently, orphans and widows and people like this have very little help. And a lot of the widows are just starving, and there's very little hope. I've known of widows a lady and her husband would have a small little store. We call it a petty shop. And then the man would die, and the people would stop doing business with the woman, and she would go completely out of business and nearly starve to death. So we started this goat program. I work with Brother Jim Waldron. He's real heavy into this goat program, and I'm thankful. But we'll buy anywhere from 5 to 7 goats for a widow, give her $10 a month for 18 months until those goats are grown, and then she's selling goat milk, and she sells her newborn goats, and she's set for life. And some of these widows now have herds. You know, one of them came to me not too long ago and said, I need help again. I need a barn because I have so many widows. I said, go build your own barn. And by the way, it's time for you to start sharing with some of the other widows the goats that you have raised. But anyway, we're very thankful for everything we do in this work. You'll find everything we do is to cause the Indian people, our Indian brethren, to be self-sustained. I'll talk about that just a little bit more in just a minute. So what's happened, and we find that the people are very receptive. God is the one that gives the increase, as it says in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 6. You know, I think sometimes people get confused about that. They think God gives the increase because he comes into somebody's mind and tells them to go over here and do this and hear the gospel or whatever. God has given us the increase through His Son, Jesus Christ, and the blood that He shed, the sacrifice that He made, and giving us the words of Jesus Christ through the Holy Spirit. And by studying those words, then we have an increase as a result. God's done everything so that there is an increase. God is the one that gives us the increase, and we give Him the glory for this. But anyway, 4 years ago, we started setting goals. We determined 4 years ago we wanted to baptize 4,000 souls that year. The year before, it had been like 2,700. But that year, they baptized 4,150. 2015, the goal was set for 5,150. We wound up with 5,162. 2016, it was 6,150. 6,166 was what we wound up with. 2017, the goal was set for 7,300. It went 7,331. So every year, the goal has been exceeded. Now, what that means is in the last 4 years, there have been a total of 22,809 souls that have been baptized. Now, the most important number is the next thing, the next question that people always want to know, but how many of those are still faithful? More than 90%, and I'm being conservative when I say more than 90% of all of those that have been baptized in the last 4 years are still serving and still faithful, and many of them are now in training to become preachers themselves. But in any way, in just a minute, I'll explain how we believe that, what's helping us with that. The goal that's been set for this year is 9,000 souls to be baptized. Last week, we just finished up a campaign. Last week, there were more than 2,200 new brothers and sisters in Christ. And I also want to say that this is not something that just happens, even though we have a campaign, and many of them are won during that week. The brothers are working with people and having Bible studies working up to the time when we have these campaigns. And so there's a lot of background work that goes into that. I meet with the brothers, a group of brothers I work very closely with. I meet with them every year. We discuss what's working, what's not working, the things that aren't working. I'm also a self-supported man, and in my store, when something's not working, it gets thrown out. I've got a back room full of stuff that, by the way, does anybody need a fidget spinner? I've got a ton of fidget spinners if anybody would like to have one. But the things that don't work, we throw those out and bring things in that will work. And so that's what we do every year, is we get everybody together to discuss the programs, what's working and what's not working. Now, as I mentioned, 106 new congregations were established in 2017. This is one of the graduations that I attended recently in Tertony. There were 10 men who graduated. It was a real moment in the work. To me, as a matter of fact, it brought tears to my eyes, because at the end of my little graduation speech, they moved me out of the way. The local congregations had gone together and had bought communion sets, and that's what these graduates are holding, because that's a very valuable thing in the churches there. Every one of them got a brand new communion set and a brand new, it's a bag on a stick that they pass around to collect the contribution. All of these men got one of those. Now, the reason they got one of those is because every one of those men had started a congregation during the 2 years while they were in school. And this is very important. The curriculum is such that the teachers in the school for the first 9 months, they're taught in class. After 9 months, they go out in the villages where the men are from, the students are from. They teach the classes to the men in the villages, do evangelism work, show the men how to conduct Bible studies with Hindus or Muslims or whatever, and how to start a congregation and how to keep that congregation faithful. So it's very hands-on training. It's a wonderful, wonderful program. Now let me go on to say one more thing. Brother Phil and I were talking about this earlier. These men are not supported once we give them about 50% of what they need to make a living while they're in school. We call that a stipend. After they graduate, they get no support whatsoever. And they know that coming in. If we need to help them learn a profession, then we'll help them learn a profession. Whatever we need to do to help them to be self-supported. Now, what that means is these congregations, the 100 and six congregations that were established last year, every one of those is manned by a self-supported preacher. Okay, so tomorrow, if they pulled me out of India and we got completely stopped, all of these congregations continue because they're not depending on foreign support. And the preachers are not depending on foreign support. A lot of times preachers will come to me and they say, "Brother, I could do so much more if I just had support." And you know, and that support's only $100 a month. And you know, a lot of times in our American brethren, they think, "No, that's what we need to do. If we can support a preacher for $100 a month, let's do five of them." No, it's detrimental to the work. You know, it's kind of like feeding a bear a peanut butter sandwich. Once you feed a bear a peanut butter sandwich, he'll never go back to the berries and nuts again. And once men are on support, you just can't get them to go back to that, to go back to supporting themselves in India. So I tell them, I say, "You're probably right. That's a good idea, you know, because it's perfectly fine, and we need to have preachers that are supported, but your support needs to come from India. So if you want your support to come from India, you go and start more congregations and convert more people and take your support from the contribution here in India instead of from foreign source." So I love that about this work. I love the fact that the thousands of congregations that have been established are all just self-indigenous, self-autonomous, and I just can't say enough about it. This is just me meeting with some of the men. We've tried many different kinds of programs, and I'm discussing that with some of the preachers. I'm not going to go through this, but it's just we train men for 2 years. They come into it. They have a new congregation. Point number two, we have what we call Saturday schools. We call them kingdom builders in India. These students have a new congregation now. And so they take anywhere from 3 to 5 men who are lead men in their congregations who are willing to make a 2-year commitment. And they're in school then on Saturday from 8:30 to 12:30. They have 4 hours of class with 3 memory verses and an examination. They break for lunch, and then after lunch they go out and evangelize until 7 or 8 o'clock at night. Right now, there are 166 of these Saturday schools in place in these new congregations. Now, you talk about establishing, getting a new congregation established in the faith. This is the reason I believe that that number, that retention number, is much higher than 90%. If you're a new Christian, you're going to get visited almost every Saturday, and you're going to have a Bible study. As a matter of fact, these brothers study with the new Christians almost every day, and they work very hard on retaining them. And of course, then after they finish that 2-year program, some of them may decide that they want to go to the school of preaching. And 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 2 says, "The things which thou hast heard of me among many witnesses, the same commit thou to faithful men who shall be able to teach." Not flakes. There are flakes out there, but what we want to do is we want to train men who are sincere men. A man that's finished this 2-year Saturday school, you have a good faithful man to come into the school. So it is a wonderful cycle, and right now we're just working to perpetuate that cycle. Again, these men are self-supported. When I'm in India, I just show up. A lot of times, people do not know where I am. And sometimes people don't even know if I'm in the country. And I'll go to one of the schools. This school was supposed to start at 8:30 in the morning. I showed up at 8 o'clock, and the men all were there before 8:30. Many of them were already doing their homework. And as a matter of fact, what I did then is I passed out papers and I said, "Everybody write your memory verses for the day," because they have 3 memory verses every day. And this just kind of, you know, it just kind of keeps everybody in line. And that's what my elders expect. They expect for me to come back and report to them how all of these schools are doing. So this Brother Ramraj on this side, he is a wonderful teacher, and he does everything in India, we say, a pukka way, which means a very correct, very determined way. He does everything, and I'm thankful for him. That says 13, but there's actually, I recounted, and there's 14 schools of evangelism. The state that we principally work in is the state of Tamil Nadu. Now, up there at the top, you see Guntur. That school is in another state. That's the state of Andhra Pradesh. But all of those other schools you see are schools that are scattered all through Tamil Nadu. And the one that I was telling you is it's down here at the bottom. We moved into a territory that's really basically untouched with the gospel. And so we've just started a new school in there because we've come up with enough men. We have good faithful men in there. And so we're really starting to work in that area. I'm very excited. I think in this last campaign they just baptized 71 souls. So it's going well. As I said, there'll be our goal is to have 9,000 souls baptized during this year. I don't know where that number is now, but I think it's probably around between 5,000 and 6,000. And so, Lord willing, we'll exceed that goal. Well, go back now and think. You know, 4 years ago the goal was set at 4,000, and we wound up with 4,150. Right now the goal is set at 9,000. What that tells us is that in 4 years, the amount of fruit from the work that we're seeing is doubled in just 4 years. So I'm telling you, we're very excited about the work. We're very excited about our brothers who are so zealous. This brother Aligar was a barber. He was converted. And I love this scripture in 1 Corinthians chapter 16:15, where it talks about the house of Stephanus, how they were addicted to the gospel. This man was addicted. And so people would come, and he would start cutting their hair, and he would start teaching them the gospel. Now, when you start cutting somebody's hair, you have a pretty captive audience. And so he would teach. Well, his business started falling off. And so then he started going and having Bible studies and not keeping regular hours in his barber shop. And it finally got to the point where he just had to close his barber shop. So then he took his scissors and comb and started going around from village to village under a shade tree, cutting people's hair and teaching the gospel. And the man's baptized 24 souls in the last 4 years. In the last campaign, he was in a place, and we're having a lot of persecution, but he was in a village, and these radicals came to him. He thought that they were going to beat him. They didn't beat him. But they took away his Bible, tore it up, they took away all of his tracts, all of his materials, they tore all of that up, and they chased him out of the village. Just to be honest with you, at that point, I would have gone home and had a bowl of Rocky Road ice cream, you know, and thought, okay, my day's finished. He went to the next village, and he started teaching in the next village. And there were 4 souls that were baptized in the next village. Because everywhere we see persecution, you can just get ready. God is going to bless the work. It happened all the way through the book of Acts, and we see it all the time with the brothers that we work with in India. This is the lady that you see there in the dark blue over toward the right side of the screen is Shanti. Shanti was baptized maybe 5-6 years ago, and when she went home, her husband beat her so badly. Then next Sunday, she showed up for worship service again. Went home, her husband beat her more badly, worse. By the third Sunday, we were really concerned for her life. Women are not generally treated very well in India anyway. I'm thankful for the Lord's church and thankful for the gospel, aren't we? He beat her so badly, put her in bed for a number of days. And then he called Santanaraj, the husband called Santanaraj, and said, "What have you done to my wife that you have such a hold on her over there?" And Santanaraj said, "Why don't you come and I'll show you?" So he came. Santanaraj opened up the Bible, started teaching him. So a couple of weeks later, he was baptized. Now he's the guy in the blue shirt. And he is a pillar in the church. He loves evangelism. Anytime that I'm anywhere within 100 miles of him, he says, I'm going with Brother Don. And his wife says, you just go on. I'll take care of the business. You just go. And I'm thankful because he has a very nice air-conditioned vehicle that he brings along. But the people that you see, most of the people that you see in this picture, over the last 5 or 6 years also, they have a date business. Now, this is not a dating business, a date business, those things you eat. And it has really taken off. Every morning they have a 30-minute Bible study with all of the employees. And most of them have now been baptized. So he found out I was in town. He called me up and he said, Brother, I want you to come over and speak for our 30-minute devotional. So I went over there, and that's what we have here. But anyway, they are really pillars in the church. And almost, you know, I asked him, I said, what do you do if an employee comes in here and they say, I'm not going through your 30-minute Bible study? And he said, it's never been a problem at all. He said, there are other places they can work if they don't want to do that. And I said, okay, yeah, that would really work in the U.S. This is Brother Solomon. Some of you may remember him. He was the guy that rode the bicycle every Saturday, 50 miles one way, to go to Coupon and work with the church there and ride the bike 50 miles back. I love this man. He may be the most powerful evangelist in the world. He is the most humble man I have ever seen in my life. And God is blessing him for his humility. He's not a good preacher. And I told him, I said, Brother, I don't understand this. You know, you're not a good preacher. You're not handsome. You're like me. You're ugly. And he said, yeah, I know. But I finally figured this out. This man is full of faith. And his mind is full of the truth. And when you take those two and you put them together, it's like putting a fuse in the end of a stick of dynamite. He and his men last year started 18 new congregations and baptized 1,073 new souls. One of the things that we find also, there are denominations in India. And a lot of times they exist simply because they have not studied all of the truth. You know, this happened with Apollos in Acts chapter 19. And a lot of times when men hear the plan of salvation and they hear about the church, they say, oh, we never connected those dots. And so in a program last year, there were 15 of these denominational preachers who were baptized. The building that you see here, just prior to my coming there, it had been a Pentecostal church building. But by this point, almost all of the members had been converted after the preacher was baptized, and it's now a Church of Christ church building. And we see this happen a lot of times. As I said, knowledge is the thing. And many, they have a very sincere heart, but they just don't have the knowledge. The knowledge is our part, brethren. That's why we're told to go into all the world and preach the gospel, because the knowledge is our part. Many times, it's only knowledge that stands between an individual having salvation and not having salvation. And when these men get the proper knowledge from the Word of God, their zeal causes them to obey. And one of the things that happened to me, I called Kathy, I said, this has been the greatest day of my life. And she said, you say that all the time. And I said, it's because it just keeps getting better. But I went over and I was expecting to meet with about 15 or 20 men. Before long, I realized I had 125 denominational preachers that had come and wanted to talk to me. So I immediately changed my lesson, preached on the church, preached on the truth, preached on unity. And so after an hour or two, the brothers continued. By the end of the day, 8 of these men were baptized. They make great sacrifices. A lot of these men in these denominations have support, and they leave that to come out of it. They make sacrifices in order to obey the truth. So I said, okay, how many men are willing to continue study? 90 of them got mad and left. We continued studying with about 30 more. We had 15 more that were baptized week before last. And so we're going to be seeing some great things happening. Isn't it great? You guys are a part of this. This work is the work you're doing on the other side of the world, just like us. You're parts of the body, just like we're parts of the body. And so these things are being accomplished. We couldn't be doing what we're doing if you weren't doing what you're doing. And so we so much appreciate you all. I still get to preach some. The government can't know that I'm doing this, so I go out into remote villages and preach. This was the buggiest place I've ever preached. I was telling my wife about this, and while I was talking to her, I was opening my Bible, and bugs were just falling out of it, because every time I was looking up a reference in the Bible and turning a page, I was killing bugs. It's kind of like ashes, I guess, that y'all have falling out here in Oregon right now. This place will be remembered as the place where I had the worst translator. Now you see Kathy, she's sitting down there in the front. But this translator, I got up and I said, and it was in Telugu, so he didn't know that anyone else there understood what I was saying. But there was a man there who knew English. And so I said, I want to apologize because I have this Tennessee drawl. And so my translator, David Rogers, is having a hard time understanding me. So all of y'all, please be patient with him. He stepped up the microphone. And in Telugu, he said, Brother Don just said that I am the best translator he has ever had. And so we've never seen David Rodge again. We have three children's homes, more than 200 children in our care. This is the home down at DKI. Almost all of our kids are totally orphaned, or they are totally abandoned, and they're beautiful kids, a beautiful part of the work. This is the way they come to us. This little boy here, Nagamuthu, he first came, and then the relatives changed their mind. They showed up with sticks and rocks and said, we are taking him back. None of our family is going to be in an orphanage. We had no choice except to let him go. So we prayed about it. We're very upset about it. A couple of weeks later, the uncle showed up and he said, I'm bringing Nagamuthu back to you. They took the boy. They put him in the field grazing cows. They're not feeding him. He's not going to have an education. And I promise you, you will never, ever again be bothered by a relative. We were so happy, and he was so happy. And I am the only one on the campus that he will hug, by the way. But how can you help but hug? Look at that little guy. You know, we see some of these kids, we just want to stick them in our suitcase. This is another one of the new children that we just got in. These are the kids lined up to get their food at lunch, which is a very special time for us because I can look at children in this line and I can remember that they were hungry when they came to us. And we're thankful. We believe also the kids need to work. And what these kids are doing, they're sanding down the gates, entering the campus. And these were painted by the end of the day in very many, every color you can think of. This is our third campus. The trees that you see in the background are mango trees. We have 100 mango trees, 70 coconut trees. The kids raise a lot of their own vegetables on this campus also. And this is the newest campus. We happened to be there on the day that they spotted the first mango. And so we were excited about that. Here they're shelling peanuts, getting ready to put out a new peanut crop. I said to the brothers, why are you planting so many peanuts? These kids can only eat so many peanuts. And they don't eat the peanuts. They take them to the mill, and at the mill they come back with 70 liters of peanut oil to cook their food in. And so that's the reason they're growing peanuts. This is our new chicken house. We have black chickens and white chickens. Black chickens lay black eggs. White chickens lay white eggs. And you're shaking. It's the truth. I said, no way. They took me and showed me this. And I'm going to have to... These are some radishes that the children have just collected from the garden. These are some of our boys. We train many of them to learn how to paint. We have several of our girls who are challenged, and we're concerned about how they're going to be able to make a living. And so what Sunday is doing in my store in North Carolina, I've been importing these cloth bags from India for a long time to give to my customers instead of paper bags. And so, and they only cost me 9 cents per bag. And so We've trained now these girls to where they can make these bags, and now I'm paying 27 cents a bag for them. But anyway, it's helping them to be able to make a living. This is another thing that we're teaching them to do. And all of the funds, by the way, are kept separate because the church doesn't, we don't have the authorization for the church to be in business. So all of these funds are kept separate. These are pocketbooks that we sell in our store. And we're getting ready to go into a big scale. We just bought two weaving looms, and the children are actually weaving the material that the pocketbooks are made out of. And this is one of our children who was mentally challenged, passed away this year, and so this is his funeral. The ambulance came, the children went out, took his body, they brought him in, they put him inside this box. This is a freezer box. This is what we do in India. If you die in the morning, you're in the ground by lunchtime. And we hope that you're actually dead. Guna, we had a 4-hour funeral for him, and it was a it's a good experience for the children because, like I said, it's hands-on. These boys are boys that were actually raised with him, and now they're carrying his body to the cemetery and burying him. I don't have time to go into all of these stories. I do want to say the number one thing on our campus is Bible knowledge. The kids have to get to heaven. And so once a year we have a Bible camp, bring all three campuses together for a competition just to check the teachers and be sure the teachers are doing their job. These kids will blow you away with their Bible knowledge, let me just tell you. This is Money Cundon. Money Cundon, if he were sitting here this morning, I could say, "Brother, come up here and preach a 30-minute sermon for us." He'd be here in 2 seconds flat, and in 30 minutes, you'd have to tell him to stop. And we have about 10 or 12 boys on this campus that can do this. Money Cundon is 17 years old. This is our Bible Bee competition. This year we had 850 questions. These three children knew the answer to all 850 questions. And so I had to start making things up to ask questions to break the tie in the end. That's always been my nightmare. This year it happened. These boys, all of the kids this year memorized Hebrews chapter 11 through Hebrews chapter 12 verse 3. And so all week they were just reciting this for us. And that takes about 5 minutes. And I think we could recite it in Tamil ourselves. We have races, foot races. This is Gracie. Last year in the memory work competition at the school next door, Gracie memorized 1,600 memory verses, and they start writing in the morning. They write all day up until about 1 o'clock in the morning. If there's two mistakes in a verse, it doesn't count. 1,600. We thought that record will stand. Nobody will ever beat that. Then comes, I don't have his picture, but Ajith. This is the last story I'll tell you. Ajith was a little boy we took in who was troubled. We had many staff meetings about Ajith because he was going to school and used the bathroom on children for a year or two. So he was the topic of the staff meeting. And you can imagine, the school was sending him home. Nobody wanted to be around him. So, Kathy and I were sitting there, and they announced the winner for the memory work competition with 3,600 memory verses. It was Ajith. I turned to Kathy and I said, "Do we have two Ajiths on the campus?" She said, "No, there's only one." And sure enough, he's changed. Believe me, he has changed. We watch these children go through the transformation, through the change. We believe this work is precious in the eyes of God because he says pure religion is taking care of the orphans and the widows in James 1:27. Thank you, guys. I hope you're excited about this work. It's a great work. We're very careful about how the funds are spent. And so if anybody has questions after the class, you're welcome to come up and ask me. I'll be glad to answer anything. But we love and appreciate you all. And it's very special when we get that contribution from you all once a year. Whatever it's for. I know one time it's for Bibles. You all helped us one time with Bibles. But as a general rule, it's just for whatever we need in the work. And we're thankful for you very much.